This is 4:55 on Friday, September 6th.
Okay, good morning. So make sure you sign in. I only see about 12 names signed in, and I don't know if that's because I'm not seeing everybody or because people haven't signed in, but I see there are quite a few more than that people here. Okay, so today we're going to continue talking about DNS. On Monday, we're going to have a guest in class. Bob Braden is a internet pioneer. He has been on the Internet Architecture Council. He's been editor of the RFCs. He's been on the Internet Engineering Task Force. And he's going to be visiting WSU for other purposes on Monday and Tuesday. So he's going to drop in for class and maybe not say the whole time, but at least be here part of the time. So please be here. Please think about sort of big picture networking questions that you might have, you know, like where's the internet headed sort of questions. There's been a lot in the news recently about the NSA and what it's doing with the internet in terms of spying on communications and so forth. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that, gentlemen, these are the kinds of things that I think would be perhaps fruitful for discussion with Bob. The other thing that Bob is going to do is on Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, if you're free, Bob is giving a EECS seminar in ETRL 101 over in the ETRL building. It's on the first floor right where you come in the doors. I don't know if you've ever been to something there, but it's kind of a nice little room. That you're certainly invited to, that the topic of that is personal perspective on the evolution of the internet, which I think from somebody who's been at it for going on 30 years ought to be perceptive. Yeah.
Would you mind emailing us that?
I could certainly can. There probably also are posters up around the building, but I will certainly send that out as well. Okay. So, questions. Unfortunately, I went through the homeworks with the TA, and there are several homework problems that need further addressing, but I'm not prepared to do it today, so it will take place on Monday or Wednesday next week. The particular ones that seemed to cause the most trouble were number 2, which had to do with what happened when you had multiple packets going through multiple hops, and that one seemed to cause trouble. The problem 9B that had to do with probabilities of busyness and so forth, I think we just need to go over some probability stuff. And I think something in problem 12 also was probability related. So we'll go over those next week. And make sure that everybody's up to speed on those. Any questions? Yes, Eileen. They may already be. I think he said that he had posted them. So, yes? Yeah, all right. So they're already posted. And they're on Angel. Okay. Remember that the grading here is overall sort of plus check and minus. And so I don't know what the total scores ended up looking like, because I think he gave, they may end up look like 99, 66, and 33. but don't fret over that. That's just a limitation of you can put in Angel. And so we know what they mean. They're a code. they won't be averaged in that form. Into grades or anything. Right? Anything else? Going once, going twice. So we will go on today and talk about domain name system. Domain name system. So we've talked about how hosts and routers have these 32-bit addresses in Internet, in IP version 4 at least, 32-bit addresses. In IP version 6, we'll get to 128-bit addresses. Even if you write those down in hex, they're not very memorable. For human beings, we're much happier with words and names and letters. So the domain name system addresses this problem of how do you create something that will map between human understandable names and these IP and these IP addresses. Also other things. The DNS is more flexible than just doing this, but this is one of its primary purposes. So you got to think about what it takes to do this. So if you wanted to build a name lookup service, what would you do? You would start out by saying, I need to have a server running, and I will somehow have a way to build into the server the relationship between the names and the numbers. And then I will have my clients come to me and ask the server what the relationship is between a particular name and a particular number. And we could all do that, right? That would be a straightforward thing to do. At least after we do the socket programming part of the class that's coming up. But the problem is that, of course, the Internet is a huge worldwide operation that involves literally billions of names, okay? And having all those billions of names be the responsibility of a single server causes what kind of problems? Well, it causes problems of availability of the service and just load on the service, but it also causes problems of administration, right? Who has the right to who has the right to call their name call their machine Hauser in the EECS domain? Well, you certainly don't want one global service having to answer questions like that. So the design of DNS, which started around the early 1980s, is based on distributing this database. It's still a very simple database. It just looks up names and produces sort of sets of numbers as a result. But it's distributed amongst different organizations. And the whole trick to building DNS was to figure out a sensible set of ways to partition this and then to technically implement the relationships between the different servers. So there's the distributed database that's managed by what are called name servers, and then there's a application layer protocol that allows your computers and mine to ask the DNS system to resolve names, to take names and turn them into addresses. What's interesting is that the way that the name servers themselves get populated with this name value mapping is not standardized. You can build name servers in a lot of different ways, DNS servers in a lot of different ways, as long as they sort of play according to this application layer protocol for host name lookup, they will be DNS servers. And how they get information from other DNS servers and so forth is well, there are some standards about that, but there are sort of lots of standard ways of doing that. And you play one of them or another one. Okay. So the first thing we start off with is the host name. And by host name, remember what I mean is something like www.google.com. Okay, that's the host name. www.eecs.wsu.edu, host name. You want something that will translate that into one of these 4-byte addresses. It turns out that it's also useful to have mappings between names and other names. So this canonical designation refers to the mapping between a name and an IP address. Aliases refer to mappings between names and other names. Okay, and so that's just a way of building in redirection. Mail server aliasing, it turns out that you know, suppose you want to send mail to me at eecs.wsu.edu, the name that's of relevance there is eecs.wsu.edu, but that's not the host that you want to talk to. You want to talk to the mail server for eecs.wsu.edu, and mail is sort of built in as a fundamental concept, and you can have specifically, you know, the number for eecs.wsu.edu, and then you could also have a name for the mail server for wsu.edu. Eecs, okay. And we want to spread the load of this all around. So we talked about why not centralized. Okay, so how is it organized? Well, it's a hierarchy. And hierarchy is a really cool concept in computer science that everybody needs to appreciate. So, why? Think all the way back to your data structures course. If you wanted to have an easy way to look up something, what did you put it in? A tree, right? And why did you put it in a tree? Because with every level of the tree, you got a multiplicative expansion of the number of things that you could handle. And within the context of a small part of that tree, you didn't ever have very much to do, right? You know, you could look at a parent and all of its children, and that was locally a context in which you could look at things. And if you had to search all the way from the root, well, how far did you have to search? A logarithmic distance in the total number of things that you have. So early on, so this notion of hierarchy is one that is not specific to computer science. If you think about the way that any organization puts together its employees, it typically has an element of hierarchy. If you look at the military, you know, you have the Secretary of the President and the Secretary of Defense, and then you have some generals, and each general has some colonels, and each colonel has some majors, and so on and so forth, until you get down to an organization that has millions of people in it, but nobody has to deal with very much of it. So for IP, the hierarchy starts with what are called the root DNS servers, which serve the top-level domains, okay? And the top-level domains are com, edu, info, us, mil, right? So there's just a relatively small handful of those. There's some new ones. There's 17 new ones in the last year or something like that that have come along, you know, dot name, I don't remember what they all are. Anyway, so there's a small number of these, so there's a certain branching factor at the top, and then within each of those there's branching as you go out, say, in com to the different companies. So although there may be only a few tens of top level domains within com, there are thousands of next level domains, and then each of the so the top level domains are responsible for assigning the ability of people to use certain names at this level, but then once somebody has a name at this level, they become responsible for what's to the left of there. Okay, so to do a lookup for this, what do you do? Well, you actually start at the right-hand side and say, who knows about com? Well, there are some top-level DNS servers that
people run that know about that. So you ask them about, you ask the comm servers about Amazon, and then you ask the Amazon servers about www within Amazon, and so forth. Clear? That's the general principle. I mean, we've got to get a little more specific than this before we're done. So, root name servers, there are 13 of them, it says here, spread around the world. And they all replicate, so this is the other aspect of distributed systems building, right, is if you need to make something really available, you make multiple replicas of it, multiple copies. And so the 13 root name servers worldwide all have the same information, and they will hand out information about who serves COM, who serves EDU, who serves US, and so forth. Okay. So then we have, so that those are the root servers, and then we have the top level domain servers for each of the COM, org, net, so forth. And those are actually run by different organizations. So each one of those domains is assigned to a specific organization to run, and to run it means to accept registrations from people who want to be in that domain, who want to have a name in that domain, and sort of hand out those names, and then maintain the DNS infrastructure that will resolve those names. Okay. Another concept that we need is that of caching servers versus authoritative servers. Authoritative servers are specifically designated within the DNS system as the ones that are supposed to know the truth about a particular domain, right? The other DNS servers are allowed to cache, in the sense that we talked about last time for web servers, the answers that they see going by about names in other domains. So you're very much allowed to, having asked a question about a particular name, to remember the answer. And part of the domain name system organization is a timeout mechanism that says how long you're allowed to remember that answer after you get it. So anybody could do that. And in fact, that's what we do with our local caching name servers with on each network or somewhere close by. Typically, there is a DNS server. So if you happen to go, well, if I happen to go to, let's see, on a Windows machine, you do this, /ipconfig/all, you will find somewhere. I've got so many network interfaces on this machine. There we go. Well, it should be here. Ah, there they are. DNS servers. Okay? So 134.121 addresses are around here can generally be assumed to belong to WSU. And so there are two DNS servers that my machine, my Windows machine here, is using to ask questions about names. And we ask that question, and the name servers come back with the information. We'll experiment with that here in a bit. We'll see what we can do with that. WINS servers are another kind of name server that have to do with local Windows domains, and Windows domains and Internet domains are different things. Although Windows Active Directory domains and Internet domains are sort of the same thing. So this term domain is overloaded, and just be aware of that as you use it in vocabulary.
Okay, so these local caching servers are not part of this hierarchy. They're just helpers to help the client machines like my laptop and yours resolve names. So now we get into some pictures of actually what happens. So my machine makes a lookup of a name. It goes to the local DNS server, which may answer out of its cache or may forward the request into the hierarchy of authoritative servers. And a picture of this. So our requesting host asks the local DNS server about a name. Okay, so one of the things you got to remember here is the order in which things happen. You know, you start out not at the left end of the name, but at the right end. Okay? Because this is the top of the hierarchy. So the first thing you got to find out is who knows about EDU. Get an answer to that, and then ask the EDU server who knows about Poly, and why? Not quite sure why cs.umass.edu should have the... Oh, we're asking... I see. We're asking about Gaia here. That's right. Not about Poly. So we're asking about Gaia, so we eventually get to the UMass, CS UMass server, which answers the question, where is Gaia? And then we can, let me go back there. And then once we have that address, then from then on, conversation takes place directly across here, right? The whole purpose of DNS is not to be involved in the actual communications between hosts, but just to provide a lookup service. So this is called an iterated query because the local server does each of the queries sequentially. There's another way that you can do queries that is called recursive queries, where you ask the first server that you talk to help you resolve the whole thing, the whole name. This is not approved as a way of doing things anymore because it puts so much load on the root servers. I mean, the root servers will refuse now to do this kind of lookup. Okay, so once you learn a name, you cache it. Part of the entry says how long it's allowed to stay alive, and so you throw it away after that amount of time. So the if you look back at this picture, notice that we may ask the root server about EDU, and then we go off to the EDU server. But once we have the answer, number three here, for EDU, it's going to stick around in the cache of this server. And so it very seldom actually has to say anything to the root servers, which is a very good thing because, you know, every name lookup eventually depends on what's in the root servers. So there'll be probably hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of DNS lookups every day. You wouldn't want very many of them to actually end up at the root servers. But because the top-level domain server information is relatively static, doesn't change very often, it's rarely the case that you actually have to ask anything at the root servers. One consequence of this is that if mappings change, the change may not propagate into the network very fast. And you've heard this probably from your ISPs at various times when you say a lookup doesn't work, or you want to make a change and nobody can find my machine. Well, the reason is this DNS caching, and basically things will be remembered until the time to live expires, and then they will get refreshed. One technique that people use is if they know that they're going to be changing something, they will actually go in sort of ahead of time and change the time to live to a small number, and then that sort of forces other people to look it up frequently, and then they'll make the change. And it doesn't speed up how fast you can make the change, but it does it does give you a more predictable bound based on what you're doing of how long things will take. But even though you still have to wait sort of the same amount of time, because you have to go through this period of waiting after you change the change the time to live. So there's proposed ways of actually forcing changes to go through, but as far as I know, they're not implemented. Okay, so what goes into a DNS record? So the record is what's in the database that actually contains the information about the mapping. Well, it's a kind of strange slide. It's the type field here that is being described. I don't know why they put them in that order, but anyway. So there's a type field that says what the rest of the fields mean. If the type is A, that stands for address, and in which case the name here is the host name and the value is the IP address. If the type is NS, then the name is the name of a domain. So eecs.wsu.edu, and the value is the host name of the DNS servers that can authoritatively answer questions about that, right? And this gets stored actually in the next level up domain. So eecs.wsu.edu, the NS record for that lives in the wsu.edu domain. Okay. CNAME is an alias, so it maps, this maps names, this is the one that maps names to names, okay? And MX are mail exchanger records, and they map domains to the name of the mail server for that domain. Now, there are a bunch more types of names these days, because there are now records that correspond to IP version 6 addresses, which have a different format than IP version 4 ones. There are records associated with what's called DNSSEC, which is the attempt to secure name lookup. I'll talk about this here. Problem is, remember I said there's no standard way of updating DNS information, right? The typical way that we experience is we talk to or interact with our name registrar through a website, and we just tell them what we want name mappings to be. The problem with that is that there are lots of ways for people to sort of hack into that system and change mappings. So think about what damage you could do if you could get www.google.com pointed at your host instead of Google's. Well, I don't know that that's one you'd want to do. You'd sort of probably drown in the traffic before you could. but suppose you could take over wsu.edu. You know, that would be a bad thing. The DNS as described here doesn't doesn't have very much protection against that. So the DNSSEC mechanism adds a bunch more record types that involve cryptographic keys that then have to match when you're doing updates, and that users can use to ensure themselves that the answers that they're getting from DNS actually are truly authoritative and haven't been hijacked. So that hasn't been as widely deployed in the 10 years since it was designed as it should be, but slowly getting there. Yeah, Isaac.
So is that kind of attack what is referred to as a man in the middle?
That's a way of implementing a man in the middle attack, for example. The actual manipulations are not necessarily man in the middle, but by doing that, you could become a man in the middle for a man in the middle attack. I don't truly want to go through the details of what this protocol looks like. Basically, you ask some questions of a DNS server, and it gives you back some answers. And you can do this over either UDP. Remember, UDP is the user datagram protocol. You fling a packet and you get a packet back, essentially. Or you could do it over TCP, where you actually have to make a connection to the DNS server at the TCP level first, and then you can go on and ask a lot of questions. So how do you get, what do you have to tell a DNS registrar in order to set up a domain? Basically, you have to give them some money, first of all, for the work that they will do on your behalf, because after all, there is work involved with answering people's queries over the period of a year or more to resolve your names to your hosts. So you give them some money. You have to sort of claim the name that you want in the top level domain, and you have to provide the names and addresses of the domain name servers that you're going to run, or you're going to have hired somebody to run for that domain, because it's now your domain and you become responsible for what's inside it. And out there in the world these days, there are a lot of vendors that you can go to that will set this up in a very simple way for you. If all you want, say, is www and mail, you can typically get that as part of just registering the name server. But if you want to do something more complicated, you need to come up with your own authoritative name servers. You can hire them, or you can have your own. And I was actually looking into this the other day because my wife is wanting to set up some domains, and turns out that from Amazon, as part of their cloud services, you can get a very flexible DNS implementation that you can control without actually having to run any domain name servers on your own. And again, you pay them for the privilege, but you don't actually have to have the code running, and you just tell them what sort of RRs you want in your DNS, and you do it all through the web and or APIs, and it all happens. So what needs to be in that top-level domain name server is the mapping between your name and the the authoritative name servers for each of your name servers, and then you need to have some way for that top-level domain server to tell the clients where the name server is for that top-level domain. So you need the name and the address. And once you have that, and you could put an MX record. MX record is not required, but it's a good thing. So why? Oh, I'm going backwards instead of forwards. That's why. So what can you do with attacks here? You can attempt to overload the root servers. Kind of hard because they're not expecting very much traffic from any particular place, so if it starts to happen, they start rejecting things. The top level domain servers are less protectable in this regard because, you know, the root servers, they're only this handful of top level domains, so there's not that much expectation of traffic. But the top level domain servers, you know, something like com has probably got several million entries in it, and somebody could sort of start marching through those through possibilities for that and bombard top level servers. Send bogus replies. Replies. So once, remember this time to live stuff at caching. If you get a bad information into your caching name server, it's going to stick around for as long as that TTL says. And if somebody has lied to you and given it a very long TTL, you may be stuck with it for a long period of time. Okay? So, anyway. And then you can... So those are attacks directly on DNS, and then there are things where you can actually get DNSs to... DNSs to send multiple replies to a target that never ask a question. This is a classic distributed denial of service technique where somebody sends out a lot of queries to something. The something varies, but in this case, DNS. So you send out a lot of queries, spoofing where they came from, all pointing at your target. And so thousands of DNS servers all of a sudden start sending traffic to somebody that is replies to DNS queries that it never made. Right? Overloads its network resources. Not neat. Okay, so... Yeah, 10 minutes left. Great. I want to save that and talk about that later. So we will on Monday after Bob talks, or Wednesday if we end up using the whole time with him, we'll talk about the P2P stuff, and then we'll start talking about the socket programming, and we will switch to the other book at that point. Oh, this is not what I want to do. This is what I want to do. In fact, what I want to do... It's right there to the... It couldn't find it, but I could. Okay, so... I'm going to have to turn off the light so you can see this. Better?
Yeah.
Not great, but better. Okay, so this is on a Unix machine. A similar thing works on a Windows machine, but since it's not wired into my fingers. This is my desktop machine. So, interesting things. The server address here, 127.0.1.1, is actually my own machine. And what this tells me is that my machine on my desktop is itself running a caching DNS server. It's not asking other servers, it's doing it itself. But it can find out the address of my machine. So that's all pretty dull. So let's do something a little more interesting. You can also invoke NSLOOKUP in an interactive mode. Notice that it just came back with a prompt here. And set type equal any. And then ask about okay. Well, there's a text record. Interesting. That's a pretty dull machine. Let's ask about something more interesting. Let's ask about ecs.wsu.edu. And you probably can't see it from the back of the room unless I scroll this up. Okay, so this is a much more interesting name. It says that that the information comes from a server named ns1.eecs.wsu.edu. There's a mail server associated with it. There's an expiration time, retry time, name servers, an address, the A record, mail exchanger. Okay, so mail exchangers come in prioritized lists, and there are a couple of them there. Text records are just general information, also used for NS security. Another thing we could do inside NS lookup, right now, again, notice that the name server that I'm using is the local one. I can actually change the server to ns1. Okay, and now if I ask again about ecs. Now, the information that's coming back is actually coming back directly from the ns1 server. Pound 53 is the port number, the standard port number for DNS. Whether UDP or TCP is the same port number. Okay, well, this is a handy tool sometimes. Let's try. This one is kind of interesting. Notice that this name server, the EECS name server, produced non-authoritative answers. It already had cached answers for this question about www.google.com. And notice that it's allowed to produce a single name is allowed to produce multiple different addresses. And when that happens, what a client does is it picks one and uses it. So this is a primitive form of load balancing. If everybody chooses randomly which server to contact, sort of out at the edges of the network already, you're load balancing and not sending all the traffic in the same direction. Since these answers are non-authoritative, it tells us also who is authoritative for those, and it gives IP addresses. So let's see what happens if we look up ns1.google.com. ns1.google.com has only a single address, so any traffic that goes there will be answered at that address. But notice that it's still not authoritative, and it tells us about where we can ask authoritative questions. What else can we do with this thing? Let's try the Windows version just for grins. See how lost I can get. Okay. So this is interesting. My Windows machine here is not running a local caching name server. Instead, it's referred to one that is run by WSUIT. Again, the 134.121 address. Let's see what it knows about Google. It just gave me the non-authoritative answers. But if I want to, I can say set type equal any, and then ask about, and then I get something looking something like I got before, except notice now that there's this 4A record that has an IP version 6 address in it. So that was something we didn't see before, I think. That's cool. What happens if we ask about Google.com itself? Whoa, lots of information comes by. So again, there's a non-authoritative answer. It says who's primarily responsible or what the authoritative server is. Responsible mail. So one of the things that you want to know about a domain often is who can you talk to that can sort of fix things if something are wrong. And so responsible mail address is good. Serial numbers and refresh numbers, those are all about keeping things straight across transitions. Lots of internet addresses, maybe more than we saw before. You want to send mail to somebody at google.com. These are prioritized. I think the lower numbers have higher priority. So preference 10 here, mail exchanger, would be the one you're supposed to use if it works. And if it doesn't, you can try the other ones. Alternate, yeah. Okay, anyway, fascinating collection of information lurking in the DNS servers of the world about how the world is glued together. Turns out there's also another set of domains that people don't usually talk about in class like this, but let's see if this one works. I think I want to do it. Let's try this. There's reverse DNS lookups. So, So I put in the actual IP address and got back a name. ns4.google.com. Right? That's a very handy feature sometimes. If you see an IP address going by, you can type it into NSLookup and maybe find out who it belongs to. But it doesn't always work because not everybody maintains the reverse DNS lookups for their names. For example, let's try something. Just curious if WSU 172.19.34.210.
172.19.34.210. So this should be my, yeah, non-existent domain. All right, so it doesn't maintain the reverse lookup, but so it goes, but you can try it. All right. So on Monday, Bob Braden, for at least part of the period, we'll start talking about socket programming if we can, and otherwise we'll do that on Wednesday. So have a great weekend. See you next week.